Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Bernoulli. Today we have Peter Buchvar and Ira Harris. Peter is the Chief Market Analyst with the Lindsay Group and the Co-Chief Investment Officer with Bookmark Advisors. He has a new newsletter product called the Book Report, spelled BOOCKReport.com, all one word. It offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Ira is an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was CME director from 1997 to 2003. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Rich. Good to be with you.
Great. I thought today we would talk about a few things, perhaps starting with quantitative tightening or the Buchvar quantitative tightening, as Peter is the first to come out with that term. You've written recently about that, Ira, in terms of the relationship of that to steepening curves, the 210 spread on the yield curve. Also with the possibility of buying bank stocks, there was a question from a reader. Just thought if you want to talk about that.
Well, you know, in following Peter's line, and I think, you know, from everything I've read from Peter and what he's talked about is that the next move by the Fed will be the commencement of quantitative ease before we get the next Fed funds increase. And the dynamic will be very interesting to watch. And I know out of what Peter talks about, it hinges on, you know, and now everybody else, there was an article in the FT, I think yesterday or today, talking about Draghi at his upcoming appearance at Jackson Hole. And I know Peter is probably more prone to think that he's going to lay something out to the market too. I'm not quite there yet, you know, because I view the ECB and what their final destination is different than what I think the Fed's destination. You know, it was interesting that July 26th, I believe, everybody was talking about the five-year anniversary of Draghi's famous "whatever it takes" speech, and it was kind of funny because when he said it, which was actually on July 25th, I was actually on CNBC. It was 5:30 Chicago time. I'll never forget it. And I was, Steve Leisman actually was interviewing me, and I said, well, they have a very big problem in Europe because this, all the 210 curves, you know, rates, you know, the 2-year yields in Europe at that time on the peripheral bonds were 7%. And the curves had flattened dramatically from over 100 and some odd basis points down to 70. And I said, it's all coming because of the pressure on, they couldn't fund anything even in the 2-year market. So the 2-year yields, it was a bear sell off in 2-year debt across all the sovereign Europe. I said, they got a problem. And while we were on talking about this, Draghi announces, you know, his whatever it'll take, no taboos. So I find that, you know, interesting. But when they quote that speech, he said, you know, the mandate was also the preservation of the euro. So I hang a lot on that because I think that's Draghi's, you know, I think he hides behind the veil of inflation now, even though inflation targets for whatever they're worth, and how they came up with the 2%, that's a whole nother show, I'm sure. But that discussion means that he's got something else. And the thing, and I know we've talked about it on the show, and I know we've talked about it with Peter, is that he's got to he wants to pile on as much liability, as many assets onto the ECB's balance sheet. Because I think his end game is he's going to do what the EU finance ministers and the leaders don't have the strength of character to do. The strength to do is to create a Eurozone bond. So I think that's what his final plan is. So I'm more reticent in thinking that he's going to give us a wink and a nod to some type of Buchvar QT. So that's what I'm looking at. So, but going back to the steepening, so if the Fed embarks upon this, we ought, and I stress ought, to see a steepening. But if the ECB doesn't pull back and the BOJ doesn't pull back, it won't, you know, then of course, you know, as Peter's talked about, the markets are broken. So we'll never get a real signal. There's the signaling mechanism truly has been broken by the central banks, and I tongue in cheek, you know, use Colin Powell's phrase that it's a pottery bond market now, because the central banks have broken it and therefore they own it. So that's where we lie, but we should see a steepening.
And Peter, your thoughts, you were the first to identify that term and what can happen by the Fed QT, quantitative tightening.
Yeah, I think that long-term treasuries are caught in this tug of war between the downward drag in yields because of the moderation in inflation and mediocre growth. At the same time, the Fed's raising interest rates, and there's a natural inclination to flatten the curve. So you have that on one hand, and you know, within speaking of the mediocre economy, we have the very interest rate sensitive auto sector that is essentially in a recession. On the other hand, you have this potential pull upwards as QT begins and maybe Draghi starts buying less bonds on a monthly basis. And we've seen some days, some relationships, some days not, of a move in overseas yields dragging or suppressing upwards, downwards U.S. yields. So if all of a sudden Draghi does say, you know what, starting January, we're trimming our purchases from 60 to 40 billion euros, and then 3 months later, it's going to 20, and then by middle of next year, it's going to zero. We'll still reinvest, but it'll be over by middle of next year, or then I just don't think that the 10-year German bund yield is going to be, you know, 42 basis points. I don't think that the Italian 10-year is going to be sitting around 200 basis points. So I think that the European bond market is tinder for a major sell-off if Draghi actually follows through with, 2018 tapering plan that takes him down to near nothing. And I can't imagine that the U.S. Treasury yield, regardless of what the inflation and growth data is going to sit there also at 225 if the German 10-year is all of a sudden 1%. If we rewind the tape back to 2015, over a two-month period, the German 10-year bund yield went from 7 basis points to 100 basis points in 2 months. And it definitely helped to drag up U.S. interest rates. So there is going to be that push and pull back and forth. And we saw when Draghi hinted at the tapering, you know, last month, and we saw an upward move. We saw in 8 trading days, the German 10-year yield went from 25 basis points to 54 basis points in 8 trading days, and it helped to drag up U.S. rates. Now, how this plays out in terms of process, obviously, remains to be seen. But I'm more worried about U.S. yields based on what the ECB is going to do rather than what Fed QT is going to do. Now, a combination of them both could be dangerous for longer-end bonds, but I think the ECB may be, you know, more of a dominant lever in determining that.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. If the ECB were to announce a quantitative tightening of any sort, I agree with that. Then it'll happen. I'm just not expecting Draghi to go that route yet. But if he does, yeah, I think we'll have a tremendously volatile move in the long end of the curve, especially because I think people feel, you know, it's like when the Fed talked about ending QE when they started QE, everybody said, oh, these curves are going to steepen, they flatten. And then when they were going to end it, the initial thing was to steepen. And people were going, you're removing a buyer from the markets, which everybody who's been sitting there, you know, it's almost like with, you know, Greenspan put in the stock market. If you pulled away, the action is going to be dramatic because so much risk has been put on for very little premium. I mean, risk premiums are ridiculously low across the board. When Greenspan comes out and talks about a bubble, I don't give much credibility to it because he might be right. But if I wait for it, I'll probably be broke. It's the famous Keynes line, you know, about irrationality and sovereignty.
Right, exactly.
But if Draghi or Jackson Hole, you know what? And I will be pinned. I hadn't wanted to be. You'd like to, you know, take a European August, but that becomes so critical because if he does deliver that, I think we'll see a tumultuous move. And I agree with you on the long end of the curve. I do across the board, and it'll be led by the Europeans. Now, you know, everybody will point to the Bund, and I know, you know, Gunlatch was out yesterday talking about, again, or the day before, 2 days before, about, well, German debt is mispriced because, well, yes, of course. But I would argue that French debt is probably more mispriced, being only 25 or 26 basis points richer than the Germans, because at least the German has a bid to it automatically because of the repo market, because it's the most desirous high quality liquid asset. So you always have a little bit of a bid. The French, it doesn't serve as great a purpose, and certainly not the Italian, and certainly not the Spanish. It would really cause some interesting moves in the debt markets. So, from a trader's point of view, I hope that he delivers. I just don't, when I analyze it and to think what his end game possibly is, which is the creation of a Eurozone bond, I'd be surprised to hear that from him. But if he does deliver that, I agree with Peter. We will have a wild ride in the global bond markets.
And Draghi, I mean, central banks generally, but certainly the ECB, they really believe in what they're doing. They really believe that negative interest rates has been a good thing. They really believe in the essentially nationalizing the European corporate bond market and the region's bonds is a good thing. So as long as they continue to believe in what they're doing, well, they'll continue to do it to the greatest extent. I think Draghi is running up against, you know, some logistical challenges where it's some sort of taper is almost by default rather than by his choice. So yeah, it'll be an interesting hoop that he jumps through. Now the program is scheduled to end in December. So they have no choice but to lay out a game plan for 2018, just again for the purpose that the current one's supposed to expire. So they gotta sort of renew it in some way and in some fashion. So by doing it in September or laying the groundwork in August, he's at least giving the market enough time to say, okay, now we know what the 2018 plan is. Now, basically what I was saying is that the plan can just continue as is instead of saying, okay, we're just going to extend it a year, which is very possible. But they have to tell us something, again, because it's supposed to end anyway, even though we know it's not.
Yes, you know, and I know, and I cited there, somebody ran a very good article in the FT the other day talking about the amount by just rolling over, you know, even if they ended QE, the amount, you know, but they didn't start, you know, shrinking the balance sheet. It's still a huge amount of money because of their duration that they have on, because, you know, when he started really buying this stuff. And if he does, he is 100% right. There is a shortage, and they're already in violation of every rule that was written about this, because the capital key, which is supposed to be sacrosanct, they can't meet it. There's just not enough German paper. They could not ever meet that number. And it was a design flaw to begin with. And so, you know, typically in the EU, you know what, they circumvent whatever rules are written anyway, because the European Court of Justice already determined that the primary thing is the preservation of the entire EU project, which means whatever makes it sustain itself. And that seems to be their legal binding principle from the right. European Court of Justice. So even like in Germany, when, you know, some of the more stalwart hard money people have brought cases, you know, they've lost. They've lost in the in Karlsruhe, at the German High Court, based on, because they seem to follow that same principle. So this does, I mean, we are getting to crunch time. You know, you can keep pushing and kicking that can down the road. But as Peter rightly says, we're getting to crunch time. They're going to have to tell us what they want to do. And I think the biggest surprise, and I'm sure Peter will agree with this, is if they said, and this would be a huge surprise, that they were going to start following the role of the BOJ and start buying actual equities, that would really rock the market. We'd probably see the euro drop 5 or 6%, I would imagine, because then they would know that there's no end to this, you know, that they have no end plan, that they'll keep searching for assets to keep pumping money into the system.
Yeah, that would be uncharted territory. And that I think they're not going to do, just because that's a logistical nightmare. That is a political nightmare, at least when you're buying sovereign bonds. At least when bonds are, you know, you should get paid back. But you start buying equities, I can't imagine the Bundesbank crossing that line.
Yeah, you know, that would be, as I said, that would be the greatest surprise if there is. And especially August, before the German elections, I for sure, you might hear that in October, but you won't hear it until Merkel is comfortably enthroned upon the chancellorship of Germany, because that would really rock the system. I you'd probably see Jens Weidmann, he'd be shouting from the top of the ECB building in Frankfurt, you know, are you crazy? Are you crazy? You lost your minds? But that would be a big surprise.
But isn't that what the Swiss National Bank has been doing in terms of financial alchemy, buying international bonds and equities?
Peter, you want to speak?
it's been extraordinary. And even before they got there, they cut short-term deposit rates down to minus 70 basis points. And you know, just to emphasize, I'm sure I've said this on the show before, that negative interest rates is just a tax. And someone has to eat it. And whether it's a bank that eats it or they pass it on to a consumer, it's confiscating wealth. I call it a weapon of mass confiscation. And that's all it is. So then you layer on the Swiss National Bank becoming its own hedge fund. That becomes dangerous. And now that the Swiss franc, you know, outside of today's rally, has been weakening. And let's take this a step further. Let's just say Draghi does lay the groundwork for tapering and follows through, and the euro goes north of 120, well, the Swiss franc's going to weaken further. Yeah. So it would reduce the need for the Swiss National Bank to be so aggressive.
Yes.
And maybe that leads to sometime in 2018, them either reversing negative interest rates or manipulating their currency less. You know, you could see where global monetary policy is potentially heading here. At the same time, the Bank of Japan is in a subtle taper because they're only on track to buy 50 trillion yen this year instead of 80 because they're focused on yield curve control. And we know Kuroda is leaving in April, and maybe whoever replaces him is going to change tact. And we heard from ex-deputy Bank of Japan member a few days ago, Iwata, who even talked about, well, 10-year yield curve control is stupid. Because you are destroying the yield curve for banks, let's just do it out to 5 years to give them some steepness of the curve. Well, you see a sharp sell-off in 10-year, 20-year, 40-year Japanese paper. Well, it's not going to be just in Japan. It's going to filter through interest rates throughout the world. So I guess we're sort of painting a scenario where you can get a rise in long-term interest rates globally, and not for a good reason. It's for the reasons of the reversal of extreme monetary policy that is sort of blowing up, and that central banks are losing control of interest rates on the longer end, which is probably their biggest fear.
Now, we were informed that under the impression that the Swiss National Bank was doing this for lowering the currency rate, right? Especially the Euro-Swiss cross in terms of what that is. But in July, that cross rate was making 30-month highs, and even then the Swiss National Bank was still buying. So are there any other reasons that they might be continuing to do this? Ira?
You know what? I just think that they don't have an exit plan. They you know, this has been going on and going on, because if I'm running the bank, they don't have to announce it. They're not under the same mandates as the Fed. But now, I would argue that when I do an average, a way to, of what they've spent to buy euros, because of course their biggest intervention has been buying euros, because that's what they purportedly wanted to do, to control that cross rate from, appreciating too much in favor of the Swiss. But their average price for all the interventions that they've done, they have to be making money on their euro end, which is unbelievable. But you would think that they would start entering the market. Now, it is interesting. I think it was last Friday we saw a significant move in front of my screen, so I could actually, I don't have to guess at this. I can look. Friday, there was a substantial move, corrective in the Euro Swiss. Yes, it was Friday. And I thought, maybe the bank is in. But it didn't have any staying power. I thought maybe they were actually coming in and selling their euros and buying some Swiss back. But now we're seeing it today. The cross has moved a big way. We've gone from, the range overnight has been 114 and a half down to 112 and a half. So that's a sizable move. But of course that has to do with the quote unquote safe haven status of the Swiss in the time of, tweet mania from the president in chief, which is ramped up, which has ramped up, global tensions. So you saw some move there. So we'll see if what this does. But the Swiss, it really begs the question: do any of these central banks? They don't really have an end to this. It was interesting that the Fed went that route, but of course, Yellen gave us the relatively soon comment in the FOMC in their last statement. Relatively soon, I'm not sure what that relatively soon means. Peter and I happen to agree with him. It'll probably be in September. That's what relatively soon means. I was hoping it was going to be August, just so that from a trader standpoint, I could see some of the action. But it was, the markets are too thin, and they were probably right to hold off. But this is, they don't really, this is what the Swiss are telling me, because what do you want? This was what your objective was. It's now gotten there. Even though, as we learned, the Swiss did intervene with 20 billion Swiss of new purchases in July. That just came out on Monday morning. So we now got to see that. So that helped push it. But that wasn't an astronomical amount, because they've done that much. But the movement of 4 or 5% in that cross rate over the last 2 or 3 months has been very severe. And you would think that if they really had an exit strategy, that they would be using this time. If everybody wants to buy euros, well, sell them euros. You've got them to go, and you can unwind some of this position. But they don't seem to be doing that. So it really calls the question, what is their real objective?
Yeah, the analogy I give is to almost make a war analogy, is like, this is like Vietnam for these central banks. Like, you rewind in like the mid 60s when the war first started, it was gung ho and we're going to win and cutting rates and QE and all this. And then all of a sudden they're realizing, well, they're not really hitting their objectives. Inflation's below their targets. Growth is not accelerating. So let's just do some more. Let's send in more troops. And that wasn't enough. And let's send in more troops. And all of a sudden, they realize that the war is being lost, and they got a full army, but they can't just pull out, because then the place will collapse. So Nixon wins the presidency in 1968 on, okay, we're going to get out of this war, and the war didn't end until 1975. And it seems that this is sort of what they've gotten into. And just to add on to what Ira said about, okay, let's just say they all achieve their objectives. Let's just say the Eurozone CPI goes to 1.5% to 2%, and the BOJ is successful in generating higher interest rates. Well, then what next? Well, you can be sure bond yields won't be where they are right now. They'd be much higher. And these central banks have to get out of what they've done. So if they create the next recession, if they create the next bond market implosion, well, was it really all worth it? They only they're only good at getting in. And I can't imagine what will happen if they actually reach their objectives or now try to get out. There's no foresight. You know, if you're a company executive, if these central bankers were company executives, you know, they would have been fired many years ago. No board of directors would allow a CEO to remain in place doing the same exact thing year after year after year after year with no results. But, you know, as any government official, since there's not really much accountability, they unfortunately get to do what they want with the consequences to be felt later.
Yeah, it's such a great analogy. And, you know, it fits so well with David Halberstam's great book of that period, The Best and the Brightest. Because when you sit and you listen to the financial media all day and you read the papers, they view that every central banker is the best and the brightest. Well, you know, and we saw the mess that they got us into, the best and the brightest, so to speak, with their models. And, of course, those were also rational actor models, the same that we're seeing today in North Korea. Because the world has always been, you know, the post-World War II period has been built on rational models. We won't have a nuclear catastrophe because the actors are rational. You know, which is what economics is based on, and their economic theories and the modeling is based on rational responses. Those are the assumptions that all these models make, that consumers, investors, savers, everybody's, you know, they do things rationally. But we certainly learned that in 2007 when we learned it well earlier, but we had it brought back to us. So Peter's metaphor, allegory really with the Vietnam War is right. And we're stuck in a morass and of doing more and more and more because they don't know. And of course, you know, the fallback for all policymakers, as Peter Riley points out, is a counterfactual. Well, if we didn't do this, you know, I can't argue a counterfactual. Yeah, you're right. But you'll be gone when everybody has to unwind this. You won't be there. It's like Jack Welch running GE. Yeah, it was great until, you know, the proverbial, what the Colossus he built and was it built to withstand the 2007-2008? Well, it was a good question that got tested. We see the outcome of GE today. It's a stagnant, do-nothing stock that people have finally, even though it's still a great company, it makes great products, but as far as an investment, it's stagnant. So there's so much yet to play out, and that's why the Swiss model is very interesting. Because if anybody should be extricating themselves here, it should be the Swiss. Because they've purportedly done whatever they needed to do. They've been successful. And they've made nothing but profits. And the world has accepted it. That's still, you know, we've talked about it on this show plenty of times. It still boggles my mind because I'm still trying to figure out who in their right mind purchases Swiss francs.
Right. Yeah, imagine what happens with them is, okay, they sit around their table in their office at the Swiss National Bank and say, okay, it's time to start backing away. And then all of a sudden you see the Swiss franc rally.
Right.
And then what do they do? Then it becomes like, forget about Vietnam, then it's Afghanistan. Well, if we pull out, well, then the bad guys are going to fill the vacuum. So therefore we got to get back in again. It's they're just trapped.
Yeah.
They're all trapped, and they've trapped themselves.
I agree with that 100% because their language is the same. I mean, when you listen to Draghi, it's like he's just quoting from the FOMC statement. And the Japanese, yeah, it's longer, but it's the same. It's the same stuff. And you know, and how Peter talks about it too is. This yield curve control, YCC, has been an absolute disaster because it was meant to steepen the curve. Well, the Japanese curve is at, I think, 16, I have it in front of me, 16 basis points today. It's far from steep. It's very flat. So they've failed on every metric. And the currency really hasn't done anything because of turmoil in the world, and of course, huge Japanese repatriation of money whenever they so desire, because they have so much they're like Britain in the 1800s. They have so much money invested all over the world that anytime they deem to bring it home, it boosts the yen up. So,
and you have the Japanese bank topics index,
yeah.
Which if the banks are the transmission mechanism for monetary policy, and it's up to the banks to increase lending and jumpstart the economy, well, the Japanese bank stock index is 25% below its peak of 2015.
Yeah. And I know because I own the individual ones. I own Mitsubishi, I own Mizuho, and I've sat in them for years. You know, between the dividends, it's been okay. It was a parking spot for me. And they've had a few ups here and there, but there's no way that that's a success because those bank stocks would be extraordinarily higher. Because if you look at a 20-year chart, you would gag. Well, it's like looking at the Nikkei. You know, it's
right.
If you look at it over 30 years, you're not close to even. And there's nothing in sight. But you look at that, everything that the Bank of Japan has done, disaster. It's failing. And now they've broken the JGB market is the second largest debt market in the world after the U.S. And there's days, as Peter and I talked about yesterday, it doesn't trade. Imagine that. It does not trade.
Yep. There was an article in the Journal the other day that Japanese 10-year JGBs trade about $900 million a day. The U.S., around 10 years, so from like, I think it was 7 to 11 years, trades about $80 billion a day.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they've trapped everybody with them. And now they own so much stock. It was interesting. I was listening to, what's his name, Peter? The guy from York who was on CNBC yesterday?
Jamie Dimon, yeah.
Yeah. He was talking about that they buy Japanese stocks because of the government pension investment fund, the government investment pension fund, because they kind of follow them and follow their lead because they're doing all this work and buying, quality companies, but they're in a race with the BOJ because the BOJ is buying so much equity, that I saw some numbers that in 4 or 5 years, they would own like 70% of the REIT market.
Yeah.
What is that? It is absolutely insanity. And the Swiss show us there's no way out. They don't even know how to end the insanity. So I sit here and I go, which leads you to where the trading situation is. The markets are very low volatility, and people are getting paid to sell that premium. And that's what scares me more than anything, is that it's not just the risk parity traders like AQR and Bridgewater, but it's everybody who follows them. Because as those guys as their models crush the volatility in the markets, everybody's forced into a short vol situation. So I think there's so much more risk out there that if you really got an increase in certainly if equity markets started to correct for whatever reason, and the bonds went with them, for a while last year we had the equity markets dropping with bond yields rising. So that was like death for them. And I hearken back to long-term capital. When everybody thinks they know the risk on, it's far bigger because of all the people who are copycatting and mimicking that trade.
Yeah, and just one last question on if we see a balance sheet shrinkage by the Federal Reserve and QT, could that result in increased monetary velocity?
It's a great question, considering that QE has resulted in the exact opposite. I think eventually, I don't think immediately. I think that, we have an asset price bubble that will be pricked when QT begins, along with maybe future rate hikes. But it won't be until in the expansion after the next recession that maybe we'll get that. But, if Bullard, what James Bullard said today is any indication, and he's a non-voting member, is in the next recession, the Fed will just put themselves right back in the same hole. They'll cut rates back to zero, and they'll start increasing the size of their balance sheet again and hoping and praying for a different result. And then Now, the question is whether the next time around the market tolerates that. I mean, we just think a lot about quantitative easing is psychology. And we always hear about, okay, well, I have no place to put my money, this and that. But QE1, QE2, QE3, because a lot of that money went right back to the central bank in reserves, in excess reserves, you know, a lot of the market reaction was psychology. And if you get reverse psychology, because people realize, well, that central bank put is much further out of the money than I thought, well, then you get the decline in asset prices. I mean, the U.S. economy particularly, the only thing keeping it out of a recession is the consumer. Capital spending is punk. Yes, trade has picked up a little bit, but it's predominantly the consumer. So consumer spending is also dominated by, you know, middle to upper end. And if you get a decline in markets, for example, well, that can change psychology, and that alone can put us into recession. So the velocity story may not be felt again until the next expansion, but that may be dependent on how the central bank responds to that. And if they just continue with the same old tools, thinking they're going to get some sort of a different result, well, then maybe it won't be rebounding anytime soon. Now, I think the next rate hike will be determined by how the market responds to quantitative tightening in September. If the market's very nonchalant with it and doesn't really respond, and we get to that December meeting, well, I think the Fed's going to raise interest rates again, because they are looking at the employment situation in terms of labor markets being tight and anecdotal evidence in terms of wages popping up here and there and the difficulty in finding workers. And regardless of what you think about the Phillips curve, it doesn't matter because the Fed believes in it. Now, if the market has a hissy fit or a tantrum after QT begins in September, well, then they'll obviously not be raising in December. So the irony is that the market can rally itself into another rate hike, or it can sell itself off away from another rate hike. I guess it's pick your poison then.
Yeah, I think that's right. And follow that up, Richard, with your question about will, you know, I know that Ben Hunt and Mohan Singh, is that, that's his name, right? He's a really good plumber, worked for the BIS, done some really good, and the Fed, I think, and talks about that if you bring this, you know, you start down that path, and I'm not sure, nobody has a timeline of when it'll happen, but as you put all that money back to work into the collateralized repo market, you may actually, this may fall right in your face, and for all the inflation that everybody said wouldn't be taking place, you might get some real velocity to this money that you haven't had before because it's been sitting parked. So again, it's theoretical, and we've never been here. So there's a lot of theoretics to it, and I want to see. I'm with Peter. You know what? That's why I can't wait for them to start shrinking it, just so we can start to test it. I mean, anybody who's a scientist, you got to put these theories to work. Let's find out what's going to happen. But what scares me about the central banks is that they're so afraid of going down some exit strategy. That's what's probably the most unnerving for me now.
Wow.
Great.
That's great, great insight on the insanity and unintended consequences of central bank and government interventions. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And just how can our listeners learn more about your work, Peter?
You can go to bookreport.com, as you said earlier, B-O-O-C-K, report.com. Or bookmarkadvisors.com on the money management side.
And Ira?
Well, me, you can find, I'll be at the corner bar just drinking scotch after scotch.
Okay. I'll see you there, Ira.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Okay.
That's kind of where
we're. Save me a seat.
And I'm not a pessimist, you know, but you just look down the road here. But if you know, I write fairly regularly in Notes from Underground, and it gets a good conversation going. And believe me, and when I post this, it'll get a lot of, these are great conversation. I get so much email directly from these. So Richard, the Financial Repression Authority, keep doing the work, because there's a lot to be taught out there. It really, you know, not everybody's in the same hymnal and in the same pew. So you, you need to shake it up a little bit, because again, it's so theoretical and nobody really knows. You know, as I say, it's not rocket science. The economists wish it was rocket science, because then they would know where this vehicle is going to land. They have no idea. Yeah. They have no idea. And anybody who tells you that they know, you can't know. You can give me probabilities, but again, like all models, we have to know what assumptions are built into the models to have any kind of sense of where this is going to go. And you know what? We really don't. So that'll keep this show going. So that much we know. But the fact that they really don't have an exit strategy that they're comfortable with, they have a theoretical exit strategy, but I'm waiting for them to put it into practice.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll end it there.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.